Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Throughout history, twins have fascinated people, enough so that there seems to be myths and legends of twins in most civilizations. They figure in creation stories as majestic and wise, but also as the bearers of wickedness and destruction. In popular culture, there's the cute version, the twins in The Parent Trap, for example, and then there's the terrifying version, the twins in The Shining. William Viney has written a book that explores these different variations and reactions, which you can see for yourself because the book is packed with photos and paintings and images of twins throughout history. Viney himself is a twin, which complicates the story, as we'll get to. And one of the things he says in the book is that twins attract this curiosity because they've always been seen as possessing an unusual intimacy or understanding or powerful connection with each other. Viney tells a story in the book about Marta and Sylvia Landa.
It's the mid-1970s. It's Spain. We've got four-year-old twins, and they begin to kind of exhibit unusual sympathies between them. So when Marta said she couldn't move her foot, Sylvia had hers caught in a seatbelt. If one twin was slapped, the other one would cry. And then one day, Sylvia went to see her grandparents in another part of town, I think, and Marta stayed at home. And Sylvia got burnt on her hand with an iron. Accident. And her sister, who was miles away, developed a burn-like sore on the same hand. So everyone was in disbelief. And so the scientists and the psychiatrists and the psychologists start doing tests about separating the girls and, you know, performing shows for one and seeing what the reaction of the other would be in the other part of the house, testing with their reactions the same stimulus. Tests which would appear to confirm this sort of interconnectedness, whether a light would be shone into the eye of one twin and the other one would kind of blink. And as they grow older, they seem to kind of grow out of it. And so it's sort of parked there in their past. And in the talk about twins and telepathy and case histories and romance tales about particular twins who seem to exhibit particular powers. I was always aware that twins were interesting to other people. And really, the thing that I found very interesting about them being interested in twins was that they were interested in such different things. Some of them were very interested in telepathy, whether or not twins felt one another's pain or could think one another's thoughts. Others seemed to me very interested in twins as a sort of visual puzzle. And still others were really kind of popular scientists, and they really wanted to know, what is it exactly that makes twins so physically alike? So I looked at this, and I was trained to listen to other people's interest or curiosity, and I knew that there was something there. And I had lived my entire life as a twin. I have a twin brother. And I found that there was nothing in what I had experienced as a twin that could meet these questions, these various interests, this lack of consensus. Despite being a twin, I knew very little about them. So it was this combination, I suppose, between other people and what they thought and me and what I didn't know that made me realise that this was something worth taking seriously.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. William Viney is with us for the hour. His book is called Twin Kind.
I know that from experience, almost any kind of question can come at me. And it's always a bit like that in terms of, I guess you could call it, in terms of power, which is that the person I'm talking to assumes the role of the questioner, and I have to be responsible, and I have to answer not just for me as a particular twin. I have to answer for my brother, but I have to really answer for all twins. Yeah. I am a kind of walking Wikipedia page for twins everywhere. And so I might be asked specific questions about me. So I, you know, what kind of twin are you? Are you close? Are you competitive? Does he look like you? Can I see a picture? Might even be one of them, right? Oh. But what kind of twin are you?
Yeah.
Are you close? Are you competitive? Those questions are all hung on a certain series, sometimes kind of like unspoken set of assumptions about different types of twin and the hierarchies that exist between different kinds of twinning. Also, how close you are. Like, it's a really interesting question. It looks innocent, but like, do we want twins to be competitive?
Hmm.
If you ask me, and I've asked other twins as well about this, this is a kind of something of a common experience. When I talk to other twins, they also tell me that they always have to kind of like negotiate these questions. And sometimes they have pat answers. They just give the thing back that they think the person wants to hear.
Yeah. The idea of twins being part of a community or an interest group, I have to say, hadn't really occurred to me. But you mentioned how the personal is also political for twin people, but in ways that have not, you know, formed part of a social movement. Say something about that.
I guess, you know, we now live in times where particular characteristics about ourselves are protected in law and are protected in human rights law. Being a twin, as far as I know, is not one of them. I'm not a advocate for or against the rights of twins as a special group in and of themselves. But it interests me how it is that twins don't form a group. There are millions of us all over the world. Being born a twin is a relatively universal phenomena, albeit with some really significant differences across cultures and across different geographies, different populations. And for sure, twins have experienced discrimination for being twins. And yet, twins don't form a protected characteristic in the same way as age or gender or sexuality and race and ethnicity do. And the book, in some ways, explores this from a somewhat oblique, peculiar angle, in that I try and map out how it is that twins are valued and valued very differently according to time and place, which would make it very difficult for us twins to kind of club together and work together to protect our interests as twins.
What do you mean when you say early in the book that twins are symbols used to guide modern lives? It seems like this is an important idea in the book, in the way that we think of twins today as kind of the result of years and years of this myth and legend. But how are they symbols used to guide us today? I think that's interesting.
I think what I'm really interested in terms of twins as being kind of guides is that life's very confusing. And it's deeply convenient sometimes to have this group of people who seem to suggest a way of answering intractable problems. We've seen this in recent times with the way that scientists use twins in their experiments, but also in terms of how they do science communication. This goes back into the history of science and genetics, but also in more recent work in immunology and the microbiome, the particular population of bacteria that we have in our stomachs. You see it over and over again, people turning to twins experimentally, but also in terms of a kind of metaphor and as a as figures to say, okay, well, we don't understand this. We think this might be true. And twins seem to suggest it is true. And I'm very interested in this twins seem to suggest gesture because it's something that theologians and philosophers and scientists, as I said, but also artists and filmmakers have been doing for so many years for really, really different reasons. A theologian like St. Augustine is in his book, The City of God, very interested in talking about free will and the opportunity for salvation through Christ by saying, look, I know you pagans are very interested in cosmology and the stars and when you were born under each star and so on, but you're really wrong, because if you look at twins who are born under the same stars, they die of different things at different times. So it seems to suggest that Christ is real. I'm just giving you one example, but actually, you know, fast forward lots of centuries, and you find the same thing being said using twins, but in the name of genetics, they say, look, well, you can't be just your genetics. Because if that was the case, then twins, who we know have more or less the same genetic code, well, they die at different times and they're different things. So what about X, Y, and Z? You know, take some supplements or whatever it is that this particular scientist is getting behind at that time. But twins are useful for guiding people. I mean, I have my own twin who guides me, I guess. You know, people often express to me a kind of psychological desire for a kind of twin guide. You know, there's such a thing now on TikTok and other platforms in terms of looking for and finding your twin flame, you know, your true, you know, spirit and soul companion, known as a twin flame. Again, not something that I'm pursuing myself, but there's something in twins that is deeply attractive to people, whether for theological or for scientific or for kind of emotional and psychological reasons.
And I think there's this intriguing question that comes up is how to explain how some identity markers between twins are similar, fashion sense or disposition and taste. I mean, your brother George provided a foreword for the book, and he wonders if it's nature or nurture or, as he says, an uncertain combination of the two. But how do you describe, again, maybe this gets to the expectation that we have that there's got to be some sort of connection there, but how do you explain the way we're thinking about, well, how is it that these guys seem to both like this? Or how is it that they are retiring in the way they speak? Or I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
I do. And it's a sort of narrative envelope that twins have to handle some way.
Right.
Which is to say that anything you do is potentially explained by you being a twin.
Yeah.
So whether or not if you're different, well, twins. If you're very like, yeah, they are twins. And it goes around in that circular way, depending on how much people kind of want you to be a particular kind of twin. I think that on the question of people wanting some reason for why it is that you wear a particular kind of clothing, I think that's super fascinating. It's a moment when it seems to me twins no longer are political or, in fact, engaged in the society in an economic or historical moment in which they live. Because I always say, oh, well, that's just got to do with them being twins, or it's got to do with their genetics, whatever that might be, or it's something else that I'm not going to name, which is the political economy in which we live in which mean that actually we're discussing choice and preference, but choice and preference is a blue shirt or a green shirt. And twins aren't able to have that conversation because everything is put in the envelope of being a twin. And the kinds of political subjects they can be is therefore extremely limited, at least in those sorts of conversations. Now, when it comes to, you know, nature or nurture, it's a sort of unpleasant choice between one or the other. This idea of, you know, everything being somehow biologically determined, or that we're kind of empty vessels waiting for culture to kind of tell us what to do next. But it is, it seems to me, you know, a choice between one or the other, and twins, like, sorry to loop round here, but twins are absolutely essential in the history of the so-called nature and nurture debate. When Francis Galton in the 1870s introduced the term nature and nurture, he was quoting Shakespeare's The Tempest, because he was a Victorian man and he was a gentleman and a scientist and so on. But nature or nurture was what personalities, and he was interested in men of great genius, this is what they were made of. But if he really wanted to get to the real kind of statistical grit of what divides nature and nurture, he said, it's twins. We should be using twins systematically. And in a scientific way. And ever since, twins and this kind of poor choice between nature and nurture have kind of been locked together. And it's a very interesting and very Western preoccupation. It's a very Western history.
William Viney, he's a writer and medical researcher, talking about his new book, Twin Kind, The Singular Significance of Twins. Take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about twins. Throughout history, twin people have been seen as special, as possessing a unique intimacy or understanding of each other. And twins are all over the place in ancient myths and creation stories. In some places, they were honored as gods and heroes. In others, they were evil twins, not to be trusted. William Viney is a twin. His new book is called Twin Kind. Let's talk about the beginning, like the very beginning, the beginning of recorded time, because you say that twins were there at the beginning. Say a little bit more about that, because it's so interesting how twins feature in so many creation stories from so many cultures. Say a little bit about that and what you make of that. Why would that be?
To start with the explanation as to why twins are found in so many creation stories, I think that twins are human enough and godly enough, but neither one or the other. That's to say that they are kind of intermediaries. What we find in many Greek stories is that one twin is a god, and the other twin is a mortal, Castor and Pollux. In earlier stories in the Egyptian tradition, the first gods in human form are twins. Mm-hmm. But we already got to that point where twins are sort of a kind of in between a truly unseen set of forces, a kind of a world of pure godliness, mm-hmm. and a kind of mortal world. And so I think as an explanation as to why we find twin myths in almost every world religion in different region, whether that's in Greek and Roman or the Egyptian myths I mentioned, or in Mesoamerica, North America, in African religion and in mythological stories about the origins of the earth, the creation of land and water, twins are kind of involved.
So, but we don't know why, of course. You know, twin figures, for example, you mentioned for the Diné people, the Navajo people, twins feature into their creation myths, the Mayans, the Olmec, they had myths about twins. Quetzalcoatl was often shown as a twin. His twin has a dog head, and these figures were associated with the power of the elements, like the sun and fire and wind and lightning. But I don't know if you've been able to sort of figure out why it is that twins would help ancient cultures and societies sort of comprehend that. I don't know. It sounds like you haven't figured it out, but you're just fascinated in it.
I haven't. And I'm not that kind of historian to be confident or to have those sorts of deep, deep historical kind of learning to be kind of like, I'm going to tell you why particular myths use particular figures. But I track maybe particular examples, and the one that I'm very interested in, I live in the city of Rome. Rome is said to be founded by one twin, a twin that survives a fight with his twin brother. He kills Romulus, kills Remus, and founds the city of Rome, Romulus. It's a sort of namesake place. And more learned classicists have gone through the extant archaeological manuscript material, all the kind of possible clues to try and understand how did Rome become founded by twins and not by just one king? Because we know that, in fact, there are lots of myths about the foundation of Rome that have just one king. And like over the years, the Romulus and Remus story has sort of won out over competing others. What is it that is attractive to Romans, but also to maybe their foes, their enemies, about having a violent, fratricidal origin story? And how does each society choose that story, and why do they do it for different reasons?
What was the ancient understanding of twins? And I mean, by that I mean, the physiology. I mean, it's one thing to talk about twins and myths and legends, but in real life, what did people make of them long ago? How did they explain how twins appears and developed?
If you read somebody like Aristotle's theories of twin and twin, what he would call twin generation, was very much within the context of a broader view of human reproduction. Mm. One that said that human reproduction was driven by the strength and the what he called quantity of seed of the man and the woman. And he would say that when there was a lot of seed in sexual intercourse, then there was potential for twins. It has an enormous effect on the on theories of twins and twin reproduction, because it gets associated with a very gendered view of human reproduction that is to reign supreme for hundreds of years. That said, that if there's a large quantity of seed, either from the man or from the woman, then twins twins are a consequence. Now, that could play out in different ways according to how misogynist your particular Aristotelian kind of commentator may be, and whether or not it got combined with ideas about the anatomy of men and women, particularly the anatomy of women, in the days before before dissection. There was a theory that the female uterus had multiple chambers in it, or sinuses, as they were sometimes called. And those different chambers were responsible for gendering a baby or creating the mechanism by which there would be multiple babies and therefore twins. And this is a kind of long, I'm giving a summary of a several hundred years of sometimes theological debate about how children come into the world.
Well, on that point, you mentioned Christian monks and scholars saw twins as a threat to the orders of gender and sexuality.
Right. So what we wind up with in the 13th and 14th century is a sort of perfect storm of Christian interpretations of Aristotle's ideas of reproduction, shot through with a certain view of female anatomy, and a lot of straight-up Christian morality about proper sexual conduct in that period. And so twins become kind of coded or viewed as signs of sexual promiscuity or even adultery. They become taken and read as signs of adultery. And a woman who has twins could be viewed as adulterous.
When does the idea of evil twins come about? Like, when did one of the twins become evil? I mean, it's an ancient pattern, of course, the idea of twins being the bearers of wickedness and destruction. But fast forward that idea, because it seems like the idea of evil twins is, it's an idea that we're very familiar with today in literature and culture. Am I right about that?
I think that this is part of a kind of broader question about twins as not really ever being fully human, or the worry and concern that they're not fully human. For example, twins, ancient or in fact contemporary, whether it's when it's, you know, comes to telepathy and being able to read one another's thoughts and feelings, there is a space in culture for twins to be superhuman,
right,
as in having, you know, to not being fully human and therefore having powers that we don't normally have. On the other hand, by virtue of not being fully human, in creeps the possibility that they are indeed kind of monsters, and that the particular quality of that monstrosity is kind of a secret until it's being revealed to us in states of horror, in as a surprise, and so on. So I think the question of, like, and I get this asked, this, you know, like, is one of you an evil twin? I think it's really innocently asks, and usually, weirdly, it's a question with good intentions. Mm-hmm. Like it's not meant to be serious, but behind it is this view of twins more generally, which is to say that we're not entirely individual, and for that reason, we can have great strengths and great weaknesses, that we could do great good or we could cause great harm.
So I guess that explains the idea of twin spirits, that this idea of twin spirits, as I understand it, the idea that twins are seen as two people, but they have one being, you know, one essence or soul. In some cultures, they were sacred. In other cultures, it was, I think you described it as this kind of spiritual disaster. I thought it was really interesting how one British anthropologist mentioned a particular people in South Sudan who believed a twin is not a person. It is a bird.
In doing that, is Evans Pritchard, in the writing in the 30s, having spent time in Sudan, was told by the Nuer people that twins are not people, that they're birds. And Evans Pritchard kind of took it away and tried to figure out, well, are they saying they're like birds because they have wings and they get close to God and they're like godlike? Hmm. Or do these people really think that they're birds? It was quite a kind of public debate within among anthropologists. But it's actually very common that twins are reported in different parts of Africa to be like, or to be in fact are, snakes and monkeys and other animals. And that in itself is a challenge to very Western ideas about what a human is or should be. And we live in a secular times where to talk about someone's spirit or soul is embarrassing. It's not done public. It's just a private matter.
Yeah.
And in that respect, people have made some very interesting claims about where the soul has gone in public life, which might be too big a subject for us to get into now, but it relates to twins very much because I think twins are still subjects of a soul. They still have a soul and a spirit in the eyes of other people, in ways that individuals, like single-born people, are denied a soul or are not assumed to have a public life in that way. Whereas twins are asked about their spiritual relations. When I think back to what we were talking about, the question, are you close? There's a opportunity for twins to address a way of being together, an intimacy that is not molecular or biological, and it's not necessarily psychological. It's got to do with this weird intuition.
Yeah.
Is it an intuition? Is it a vibe? And many, many twins I meet will openly talk about that because it's really important to them. I think twins are very lucky being able to talk freely in this way because I think on the whole, spiritual life for people is not something frequently talked about and done so freely.
William Viney, his new book is Twin Kind, The Singular Significance of Twins. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with William Viney. We're talking about his new book, Twin Kind. Let's talk about the scientific use of twins. There's a section, of course, in the book that deals with this. You were mentioning Francis Galton not so long ago, and of course he was a Victorian in the Victorian era. Victorians were interested, you mentioned, in twins as kind of a way of making sense of human life. And I wanted you to say a little bit more about that. I mean, the Victorians at that time and Galton, they're like, we're trying to measure the differences and the similarities of different groups, which gets to some pretty ugly thinking, of course. But what did Galton want to understand with twins? What did he think twins were going to tell him about the differences between humans and different groups?
I think at the time, very specifically, Galton was under pressure to find reliable methods to back up some of the things he was trying to prove to his learned peers, which was that he was very interested in the heritability of genius.
Yeah,
his studies of rich white men and how it is that they seem to have rich white sons who are very clever. Now, I think that I'm joking about this, but on the other hand, it's deeply serious. His entire modus operandi was very much to do with finding methods that could support white supremacy and eugenics, which is a word that he coined later on in his life, to describe the perfection of different populations and therefore the mass sterilization of unwanted subjects within that population. Is all part and parcel of a way that twins sort of entered into this highly mechanistic and highly statistical way of thinking about human life in populations. And what happened in time was that twins became a kind of industrialized, I suppose you could say. They scaled up. And twin studies, or the recruitment of twins into studies, became scaled up and made kind of a kind of industry to try and create the evidence needed to describe how particular traits moved from grandparents to parents to children, to therefore find adequate ways of targeting wanted or unwanted traits, and therefore wanted and unwanted people within those populations.
Yeah. The 1988 film Twins with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito, what did that film and, you know, the idea of that film, what did that tell us about the use of science in twins?
In many ways, it's a kind of brilliant documentary. And in the other way, in another sense, it's a kind of really canny prediction and sort of warning shot into the future. So it's a documentary in that it came out in 1988. And that was about 10 years after the first person born via IVF, or in vitro fertilization. But fertility drugs had been in the market, especially in America, for quite a long time, and they were very strongly associated with multiple pregnancies. But as the way in states and the clinics, New York, LA, the extent to which this was well documented, understood, was emerging in the 80s. So the idea that you would have, as happens in the film, a genetic lab experiment that would create twins. Twins is very significant, not just for the reasons that we talked about. You know, science is using twins and using them since the 1870s. They are kind of scientific subjects. But also, more recently, in the recent past, you know, when this film was being made, that twins are very strongly associated with the fertility industry and with experiments in fertility. Remember, they take the genetic material of many very, very eminent scientists and their egg from one very beautiful and very eminent scientist. Mm-hmm. And they try and create a kind of superhuman, right? With all its, with all the resonances of a sort of Superman sort of experiment that might have. And things go wrong, and all the good genetic material goes to Schwarzenegger's character, and all the bad material goes to DeVito's character. And I said earlier, documentary and prediction, and that's because the first germline, so that's the main genetic code, the first germline experiment resulting in the human, so that's genetically modified human, was born a twin. They're humans.
Yeah.
The first time that happened in 2018 created human twins, conducted in China. The scientist involved went to prison. He's no longer in prison, trying to rehabilitate himself as a good guy, I believe. And we don't know very much about how those twin girls are getting on. But what we do know is that when it comes to experimenting on humans, making twins is a sort of canny plot twist. Whether it's in sort of comedies of the 1980s or whether it's in the less funny reality that we live in now. And there are many reasons why that should be. But for one thing is that you kind of manufacture a case control. So that your science continues, whether they survive or not, you're always understanding more about the person that you've created, which is a sort of science, maybe a particularly scientific way of thinking about the value of life.
Have we learned important things because of twins in science?
I'm really ambivalent about this, because I can't yet judge. I think that what my book has taught me as a sort of process in research is that how you judge importance is very much depends on several things. Among them, who you think you are in the experiment. You know, are you a beneficiary? Are you the scientist? Are you the research subject? Right. And also where you think you stand in time, whether or not you're kind of downstream from it or upstream from it. If you talk to twins, as I have done, talk to twins who owe their existence to IVF and other fertility technologies, then the question of what has science done for twins or what have twins done for science becomes really visceral. And in that case, you could come back to this question of what does it mean to be a twin? Like, what's being a twin mean to you? Which one can only respond either, it's all I've ever known.
Yeah.
And likewise, the science is all I've ever known. As in, the reason why I'm here right now talking to you. But if you asked scientists and clinicians, they may give a really, really different view on that. And I think I better leave it there.
How did Shakespeare use twins? What did he think of twins, do you think?
So Shakespeare wrote two plays that feature twins.
Yeah.
Twelfth Night, and featuring Viola and Sebastian, and A Comedy of Errors, which is less kind of performed and read and discussed, partly because it's kind of crazy, and it features two sets of twins,
right,
who at a certain point swap places with one another early on, and one is a sort of aristocrat, and the other is a servant. And they go off to go and find the aristocrat's lost brother, and they turn up in Ephesus, which for theatre-going Elizabethans would have been associated with kind of witchcraft and kind of all kinds of magic. And what they get there is it's a knockabout farce, and they keep on bumping into one another's wives and brothers and so. Anyway, so it's very funny, and it's a kind of comedy, but it's also not. And twins are really a kind of plot device, I suppose, to try and get this kind of comedy moving. And there's a very poignant moment towards the end where there's two, they have identical names, the twins. It makes it very complicated to talk about. But the two Dromios, which are the servant twins, stand outside a garden. They're waiting to go into the party to celebrate the fact that everybody has been reunited. Because it's a comedy, so they all get reunited at the end. And the two Dromios say, well, should we go into the party like we did when we were born? You know, came into the world, you and then me. And they're like, no, let's do it arm in arm together. Which is a kind of really radical way of thinking about, you know, firstborn son, primogeniture, who gets what. And also about class in Shakespeare's time, which would definitely not always have been arm in arm. So that's like one play. And then the better known one, Twelfth Night, Viola and Sebastian get separated, and they show up on the island and have to take on the guise of a man. And it's one of the cross-dressing plays. And it's very exciting, and people who don't usually fall in love do fall in love, partly because of this cross-dressing business. And at the end, they reveal each other to one another, and that's nice.
You say early in the book that it takes a lifetime to accept what you are to other people. Say something about that, if you would, finally. One of the things that you mentioned in a conversation before we started recording was that the older you get as a twin, the less cute you seem, and maybe the less interesting. But I don't know, just talk a little bit about the way your life as a twin changes when you're not wearing, you know, matching jumpers like you're not, you never did with your brother George, but yeah, say something about that.
I can answer this for myself in that I think I've spent now over 10 years working on the history of twinning. I don't think I've spent every single minute of those 10 years doing that, but it's been one of my major projects, and it's culminated in this book. And I've realized that there's quite a lot of work that I need to do to face up to things that I've taken for granted, of which being a twin is one of them, right? This is not therapy, by the way. You know, like writing this book, it's not a memoir. It's a history book that's really interested in the fact that I, at some point, got labeled a twin, and I've been a twin ever since. And it's a classification that just comes at you like, you know, a bullet from a gun. And you've got no choice over it, and you've got to live with it the rest of your life. But it doesn't mean one thing or the other, and it's up to you. And I would argue, and I hope that for twins, other twins too, it's up to us to figure out what we want it to mean. I personally, I found that very rewarding. I think for me, it's been through twins that I've done that work. I think probably you can do that work via other parts of subjects, parts of yourself, perhaps, or subjects that feel like they've also come at you, sometimes against your wishes. And, you know, I'm a great advocate for learning more, arguing more, and meeting more people who have something in common with, but you don't necessarily see things in the same way. And it's a great pleasure for me to have had this book to use as a way of meeting and talking to people.
William Viney, thank you very much.
Thank you.
William Viney, he's a medical researcher and a writer. His new book is called Twin Kind: The Singular Significance of Twins. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we're on YouTube at KUER90.1. And you can email us with comments or suggestions or feedback. We're at radiowest@KUER.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.